Dr. R.J. Rushduni, RR151A1, Messianic Character of American Education, Q&A, Christian Schools.
He's the author of many books, many of which we have on sale in the table in the other building. And it's a real joy and privilege to have Dr. Rushduni with us. We're starting a little late. You take all the time you need. We're in no hurry.
Our subject this first hour is the messianic character of American education. However, I'm not going to give a book review of my book of the same title. If you want to know what I say in the book, read it. What I'm going to do is to speak on the subject rather generally and bring it up to date, as it were. Alexander Pope, an 18th century poet, in four lines expressed a fact which is all too true. He wrote, "Vice is a monster of so frightful mien as to be hated, needs but to be seen. Yet seen too oft, familiar with her face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace." This, unfortunately, is the situation with regard to government schools. When they were first proposed, Christians recognized them for the anti-Christian movement that they are. The sad fact is that all too many Christians defend the government schools today as though it were a part of our American heritage. I heard the governor of a major state 2 years ago, a man who is an evangelical and a Sunday school teacher, defend the public schools and summon all good conservatives to come to the defense of this very socialistic institution. Let us examine very briefly the origins of state control of education and then analyze the goals of statist education. The intellectual origins, very briefly, are in Hegel, who saw the state as the central institution of human society, as God walking upon earth, and in the American followers of Hegel, the transcendentalists. The political origins were in Prussia. Horace Mann was an imitator of Prussia, and in the American socialists. The religious origins of state education are unmistakable. All the key figures in the inauguration of statist education in America, without exception, were Unitarian. They were anti-Puritan to the core and anti-Christian. Their goals were to first separate biblical faith and the schools. Second, to give the state priority in life. Third, to provide statist, that is, non-theological social order. And four, to give man salvation without Jesus Christ. It is interesting to analyze some of the key figures in the origins of the state school movement. Within education, the two major figures were Horace Mann and James G. Carter, both of them Unitarians, both of them statists. Both of them believed emphatically that salvation is by education, non-Christian statist education. They believed that with humanist education, and Mann was very vocal on this score, the time would come a century hence when America would be a cleansed and purified land, when crime, poverty, sickness, and all social problems would disappear, and if the America of the 20th century had any prisons, they would be as museums, so that Americans of the 20th century would see how crudely and savagely their ancestors lived. Of course, to cite man's hopes is to mock man, because everything man stood for not only has not been realized, but has been proven to be as false a hope as ever deluded man pursued. Two other figures were very influential in the movement which led to the first statist system of education in this country, in Massachusetts. One of them was Charles Sumner, Senator, Unitarian, bitter enemy of Christianity, an abolitionist leader, an infamous senator. But even more central was Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a Unitarian minister and a very wealthy man who at one point remarked that he always had money to spend for treason to his country. Thomas Wentworth Higginson not only helped finance the move that led to the formation of the first state system of education in this country, he also helped finance John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in the hopes that it would create war, which would, he hoped, lead to a revolution. Higginson had a long and an active life. He lived long enough in 1905 to be one of the five men who founded the League for Industrial Democracy, the LID, and also the Intercollegiate Society of Socialist Students, which trained the Ruthers and many of the most prominent Fabian socialists of the 20th century. Indeed, the products of that group dominated Washington when the LID celebrated its 50th anniversary in 1955. Now, the statist schools have propagated a very extensive mythology which governs people's ideas concerning statist education. This mythology can be summed up under two heads. First, that all public or statist schools are concerned with objective, neutral education. Here is non-sectarian, non-partisan education, supposedly, just the facts. Second, the idea is propagated that recently troublemakers have deflected the state schools from their original purpose. And if we only get back to that original purpose, all will be well. Both premises, both myths, are totally and radically wrong. The idea that there is such a thing as an objective education is an illusion. The idea of neutrality and objectivity are myths. Man cannot be neutral. Man cannot be objective. Only God can. When I stand here and look out at this room, I see it from a perspective. When you sit there and look, you see it from a perspective. You can neither see me or the room in its entirety. First, you can only see the front of me and the front of this sanctuary. And second, you cannot see all of me, that is, the inner man. Your perspective is limited, even as mine is limited. It is partial. It is from a particular point. It is a perspective. It does not encompass the totality of things. Only God stands apart from the whole created order. Only God can see all things, the beginning and the end, as well as its totality. Only God can see the inner man and know it in its entirety, as well as the outer man. Thus, when the humanist claims that man can have autonomous, objective knowledge about reality, what he is saying is that man is God. Because that kind of knowledge is only possible to God. Thus, a basic premise, a latent, a hidden premise in its origins of statist education is, ye shall be as gods. In other words, it has adopted the premise of Satan and made it its gospel. Now, the other half of Satan's statement is knowing, that is, determining for yourselves what constitutes good and evil. This is precisely what the statist schools presume to do. Having abandoned God and His Word, now man, in terms of his own concept of what constitutes right and wrong, analyzes and determines good and evil for himself. Thus, man, in secular, in statist education, is prepared to be his own God. Right reason is held to be capable of objective, neutral analysis and a transcendental critique of reality. The academy or the university is the ivory tower from whence right reason surveys reality and comes up with authoritative, godlike judgments. This is the mythology of statist education. It is the mythology of humanism. It is, in essence, original sin made into an educational philosophy. This is why Christian education must not only have its own philosophy, but it must develop its own curriculum. I have a book not yet typed and in the hands of the printer, which goes precisely into this area of education. The concept of a Christian curriculum. It is urgently necessary because Christian education must be root and branch, thoroughly biblical, thoroughly cleansed of this myth of objectivity. The only objectivity to which we can lay claim is God's objectivity. And when we stand in terms of His Word, His declared truth, then we have the only link to objective knowledge which man is capable of. Our knowledge is subjective. This does not mean it is necessarily wrong, because when it is premised upon God's Word, upon God's truth, our subjective awareness can lay hold of truth. We have dealt very briefly with the goals of statist education. They can be summed up really in one form. The basic function of statist education is to uphold the state. The Marxist state will have a Marxist philosophy of education. The Fabian socialist state will have a Fabian socialist philosophy of education. The democratic state will have a democratic philosophy of education. The national socialist, the fascist, and so on will have one in terms of their basic philosophy. Every state school is concerned with furthering the life of the state and the faith of the state, the religion of the state. Every state has a religion. The idea that you can separate religion and the state is a myth. As a matter of fact, throughout history, the most important religious institution has been the state. Outside the world of the Old Testament and outside of Christianity, every state was, in essence, the central religious institution. It was divine. The emperor or the ruler was a god. The office was a divine office. Civil government has always been a religious institution, all too often the central religious institution. It was the great work of Christianity that it de-divinized the state. It said that the state was under God, but not God. It declared that the state had a positive duty to be Christian, but it could never presume to be God or to be divine. The state is religious, inescapably. If the state is not Christian, it will affirm another religion, and the religion of the modern state is humanism. The state is a religious institution, inescapably so, because every state is a law order. Now, every law order is concerned with morality. Thou shalt and thou shalt not. All law is simply enacted morality. This is inescapable. All law is either enacted morality or procedures for the enforcement of enacted morality. This is true of your traffic laws, by the way. Traffic laws deal with the protection of life and property. Thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not steal by your reckless driving. The degree to which traffic laws, incidentally, are observed depends on the degree of evangelical faith in a particular country. People who have traveled in the Far East tell me that you don't know what hair-raising experiences are until you drive with some native driver in the Far East where there is no Christianity. The lowest ratio of accidents per cars and miles driven, incidentally, is in the United States, where you still have more evangelical faith than you do in almost any other country in the world. Now, every law system represents, therefore, a moral system, and every moral system represents a kind or of theological order. Thus, every state is implicitly or explicitly a theological order developed into a particular kind of structure. Moreover, in any system of thought or philosophy, the God of that system can be located wherever law originates. Wherever law originates, there you have the God of that system. This is inescapable. And therefore, when law originates, as it does with us today, with man, not in terms of God's law, but in terms of man's will, then you have the worship of man, the religion of man, humanism. Max Weber, a European sociologist, said at the beginning of this century that the function of European education was to train civil servants for the state, whereas the function of American education was to train citizens for the state. That was a good many years ago that Max Weber wrote. But Weber very clearly recognized that which most Americans took 50 to 70 years to recognize, namely that the purpose of the schools is not to educate. The purpose of state schools is to train citizens and to train them in obedience to the state. The basic socialism, you see, is the socialism of the child. It is impossible for parents to object when the state takes their property and their money, when they have already surrendered their child. And you will never undercut socialism without undercutting its hold on the child and its hold on the mind religiously. We'll deal with that in a later hour. In 1938, the NEA defined the purposes of education in American democracy as fourfold: self-realization, human relationship, economic efficiency, and civil responsibility. This definition, they proudly said, was in terms of social democracy. They were openly anti-Christian as well. Now you note, as they defined education, they never said one thing about learning. They never mentioned that. It wasn't that important. The basic purpose, you see, was to train the child in democratic living and civic responsibility. Hence it is, in terms of democratic living, the next step was, of course, integration. The next step was, of course, the new morality. The next step was, of course, to open the child's horizons in terms of a total humanism. Democratic living. Not Christian living, democratic living. Moreover, they went on to state, and I quote, "The entire curriculum, the entire life of the school, in fact, should be a youthful experience in democratic living, quickening social inventiveness and agitating the social conscience, so are citizens for the democratic state successfully educated," unquote. Now, I submit, with the change of a single word, this definition in substance is what Hitler would have been pleased with, and what the Soviet Union would be pleased with. Substitute, instead of democratic, fascist or Nazi or communist. And it will read, "The entire curriculum, the entire life of the school, in fact, should be a youthful experience in fascist, Nazi, communist, living, quickening social inventiveness and agitating the social conscience. So our citizens for the Nazi, fascist, communist state successfully educated. The goal of statist education in every society is essentially the same. The label changes, but the reality is unchanging. The child and man for the welfare of the humanistic state. Thus, whenever you have statist education, the first function of the school is to serve the state in its social order. And second, as the NEA very plainly said, the conscience of the child is to be agitated not towards God and his moral law, but towards the social group, to further, in terms of their own phrasing, social conscience. Not godly conscience, but social conscience. But what if parents want an education oriented towards God? Such schools through the years have been condemned by the NEA, however high their caliber of learning, because they declare the democratic experience is lacking, and there is no orientation to a social conscience. The schools have always been what they are now, only they are now more openly so. Their purpose is to enable the state to preserve itself and to mold the child into a statist mental caste. We thus face a very real warfare. We are in a situation comparable to that of the early church in the Roman Empire. The whole world today is socialist. The labels vary, but the reality is the same. The degrees of socialism vary, but the fact is omnipresent in every country. The early church at any time could have avoided persecution. Rome had no desire to persecute any religion. As a matter of fact, the avowed policy of Rome was to recognize, legitimate every new religion and put it to the service of the state. The Roman philosophers, like the Enlightenment philosophers, were very, very open about their use of religion. They did not believe in it. Cicero, who tragically is a hero of some conservatives and should not be, regarded the gods as a myth, but he felt belief in the gods was very valuable. After all, and he was very much like Voltaire in that respect, if my servant doesn't believe in the gods, he may rob me. But as long as he believes in the gods and believes in that nonsense about the gods punishing you if you don't behave, then he's safe to have around the place. The Roman philosophers, therefore, very openly regarded religion as social cement, as holding society together. The emperors, therefore, did everything to recognize religion and to make it serve that purpose. They were not new in this. The Greeks had done it before them, and many other states before them. We have a relic of that usage of religion in our word liturgy, which comes from the Greek and which literally means public work. Religion was once the Department of Public Works of the state, to keep a state in line, to keep the people in line for the purposes of the state. The Roman emperors, therefore, did everything to woo the early church. If they would only go through the motions of recognizing that Caesar was the mediator. Just go through the motions. A little incense on the altar and then go your own way. We won't bother you. The struggle was inescapable because of the church's commitment to Christ and the Word of God. As a matter of fact, St. Paul very early threw down the gauntlet when he echoed a Latin expression with a change of name. It was the Roman theology that there is none other name under heaven by which men may be saved than the name of Caesar. The state was man's savior. The head of the state was the mediator. And St. Paul declared emphatically, there is none other name under heaven by which men may be saved than Jesus Christ. This is why war was inevitable. War between Christ and Caesar. War to the death. And it was that. Nowadays, the tragic fact is that our mythologists in the schools are telling us that the idea of the Christians being thrown to the lions and being ruthlessly executed in the arena and elsewhere is myth and legend. It was all too true. We have eyewitnesses reporting very early martyrdoms. For example, of Perpetua, a very moving and powerful account. She and her friends, young people, young mothers, facing a meaningless Roman Empire, a few generations only, early in the second century after our Lord, and finding life all around them meaningless, began to try to find some meaning, some purpose, salvation. And they went to meetings and homes and found Christ. And they were also arrested in such meetings. And we have an eyewitness account of Perpetua. She had just given birth to her child. And the Roman official, as a friend of the family, because she came from a very prominent pagan family, telling her, have pity on your father. Don't disgrace him by associating yourself with this illegal group. And her parents holding up her baby and saying, just walk past the altar, put a few pieces of incense on it, and come and join us. Your baby needs you. And she reporting, we have her actual words, that her breasts were heavy with milk and ached for her babe. But she could not. She and countless others went to their death rather than surrender. In the great persecution of Diocletian, the order was to eliminate all the Christians wholesale. And we are told that the executioners with their swords and their axes worked steadily, one head after another rolling, until when it came time to relieve them, either for lunch or because the day was over, their hands had grown numb on the handle and had to be pried off. But it was Rome that lost, and Christ that triumphed, as he always shall. It is a battle again between Christ and Caesar, and there is no doubt about the conclusion, no possible doubt. The only question, of course, is where will many of the church members stand in the battle? With Christ in victory, or with Caesar and his certain defeat? Today, the critical arena is the Christian school. There was a very interesting article a few months ago in the Los Angeles Times, one of the most powerful and more liberal papers of the United States. It was called The Quiet Revolution. This amused me because I have often used that term in describing the Christian school movement. However, the ironic fact is, as they described the tremendous growth in the past 20 years of non-governmental schools, and the fact that these schools are springing up all over the landscape, they never once mentioned the fact that these are Christian schools. Private schools are closing their doors. They're finding long-established, once very successful schools that they now have insuperable discipline problems, and they cannot cope. They cannot cope with a child without a moral and a religious premise. One school in California, which has historically a waiting list, is one of the five or six most prominent private schools in the United States. It is more important, as a matter of fact, to say that you went to this particular school than to say you are a graduate of Harvard or Yale. In social circles, as well as in corporate circles, it means more. Usually, registrations were for years and years in advance. When your child was born, you placed him, if he were a son, on the waiting list for the school. Now, for the first time in their history, they have no waiting list. These schools are closing their doors. The quiet revolution that the LA Times spoke about is not in the area of private schools. It's not in the area of the traditional parochial schools. The Catholic Church, unfortunately, is retreating badly in this area. It has been closing down schools at a drastic rate. Well over 200 a year. Incidentally, many of these are closed because the bishops do not believe in them, and others because the teaching nuns will not go along with the left-wing tendencies of their church, theologically and otherwise. As a matter of fact, parenthetically, one very beautiful plant, a $4 million plant operated by some nuns in Los Angeles County shut its doors down a year ago, June. There were 700 or 800 pupils there, And it is interesting that the end of the school year, the nuns sent letters, unauthorized, to all the parents recommending where their children should go to school for their moral and spiritual welfare. And the recommendations were all evangelical schools in the area, and virtually all the children wound up there. Very interesting development. The battle is being joined, however, between Christ and Caesar in the area of the Christian school. And this is why we can expect in the days ahead more and more repressive legislation, more and more roadblocks. On the other hand, we can also expect more and more attempts by legislators to curry favor with the schools, precisely because they are recognizing that so many parents are becoming involved that the Christian school movement has political force. 2 years ago, the governor of California went to the Association of Christian Schools convention and spoke at their banquet. It is not because our governor is interested in Christian schools, but he is interested in votes. And he had been advised that there are so many parents now involved in this movement, it would be wise not to neglect this area of interest. As this battle between Christian schools and the state is joined, between Christ and Caesar, it becomes therefore all the more imperative that we as Christian school teachers and administrators and sponsors supporting churches or boards become aware of the basic issues and have a clear-cut awareness of our premises. The state school knows what it believes. It applies it systematically and thoroughly. It is a radically humanistic faith. It is imperative for us, therefore, to rethink Christian doctrine, develop a systematic philosophy of education, a Christian curriculum, so that root and branch, our schools are Christian. I believe that the Christian school is the key to the future. I believe that today the opposition recognizes this. I began to believe that when I wrote my book, The Messianic Character of American Education. One of the very interesting things that happened when that book was published was the fact that I began to get reports. In fact, I got a copy of one or two reviews made by various state boards of education across the country. Publicly, they never acknowledged the existence of the book. Privately, they asked someone to review it. The thing that amused me was that in one major state, one of the public officials who wrote the review became a convert to the idea of Christian schools from reading the book. I was also made aware of the significance of the issue, how important this issue is in our day. When recently my son-in-law, Gary North, who is with the Foundation for Economic Education, was asked to write a review of several books in education for a major publication, one of the most important publications in the United States. In the second paragraph, he included a reference to my book, The Messianic Character of American Education, just one sentence. The editor immediately wrote back that that statement had to go. There could be no reference to that book, and he would say no more. Fortunately, Gary stood his ground and the reference was included. But it is significant that he was aware of the book. He was aware of the book not because the book is that important, although I think it's a good book, but because the issue that is at stake is so central to our time. How can you have a statist society, a humanistic society, when today about one child in three is not in the state schools and the state grade schools? When one child in 10 is not in the state high schools, and in both areas the percentage is growing every year? And when the real growth is the Christian school. This is the quiet revolution. It is, moreover, the quiet warfare. St. Paul long ago gave us the counsel for Christian warfare, the whole armor of God. And it is with this that we must prepare ourselves for the days ahead. If we so prepare ourselves, we shall be a part of the inescapable and the inevitable victory. We have a little time for questions. Anyone have a question? Yes.
I would like to, you were touching on this while ago, speaking about the Christians being fed the lions and so on. And I'm wondering about the idea of Christian militancy, because I've heard so many say, it's not my job, I've had preachers tell me this, it's not my job to oppose communism, it's my job to preach the gospel. And usually they're gospel preaching is just the surface baloney, as far as I'm concerned. And,
yes.
I'm wondering, as far as the early church is concerned, the only thing I ever hear is the Christians were thrown to the lions, and that's it. And yet I see in the personality of Peter a man who was given to resistance against materialistic forces. And also I see it in the character of Paul, that did the early church, were there any actual resistance movement to the Roman Empire?
The question is, were there any resistance movements to the Roman Empire? No. There were action movements. This is the key. You see, today we are too much concerned with resistance, opposition, too little with action. For example, one of the things that the early church did was this. It was quite common in that day for babies to be abandoned under the arches of the bridges of Rome. Before them, the Jewish believers of Rome had done this, and the Christians very quickly followed suit and surpassed the Jews by far on this. They would collect those babies and rear them as Christians. Very significant step. They were training up not only their own children, but abandoned children to be soldiers of Christ. Then again, the Christians took care of one another. This was a very significant fact. They took care of their aged, they took care of their sick. In every congregation, Christians took care of their own. And if there was need elsewhere, they took care of them. Remember St. Paul, the collection for the needy of Jerusalem where there was a famine. It was regarded as a necessary aspect of Christian society. Now, this was a very important fact and a very deadly fact, because the Roman Empire was in the business of providing bread and circuses, cradle to grave security. Under Aurelian in 275 or 6, in fact, it said that even the children of welfare recipients would have welfare as a hereditary right, and their children and their children's children after them. They were going to take care of everybody, but the Christians proceeded to take care of their own. They were creating a state within a state. Let me add parenthetically here, in the Soviet Union, it is an offense against the state and counter-revolutionary to indulge in private charity. If you as a Christian are living in an apartment building and Mrs. Ivanov is sick and her husband is sick and they have no income, and you take up an offering among your fellow Christians there or your friends to take care of them, you are guilty of counter-revolutionary and illegal activity. Private charity, Christian charity, is strictly prohibited. Why? Because it creates a person-to-person and a person-to-God bond, as against a person-to-state bond. Now, this is precisely what the early church was doing. It was taking care of its own. It was educating its own. It was a society that was the envy of those round about. If it hadn't been for the fact of persecution, most Romans would have gladly joined the church, because that's where all the benefits were. It was obviously the most desirable society. Now, they were busy creating a Christian society. And they were creating a new order amidst the ruins of an old order. I believe this is our function. I believe we are at the end of the age of the state. Now, we may linger in its ruins, as some people believe, for two centuries of slavery. Or we may create a Christian civilization the world over. The difference will be entirely up to the Christians. I can waste my breath from morning till evening talking against what Washington does and what our state capitol does and our board of supervisors and the communist infiltrators and the terrible people in our public schools. And what have I done? I had a woman come to me who was very prominent on a national level in conservative politics. And she told me with tears, she said, "I was so busy saving the country that I lost my girls. And one of my daughters was involved in narcotics, in sexual delinquency, in every kind of depravity unimaginable, while I was busy flying from one end of the country to the other, trying to save the Republic." You see, it isn't in taking a stand on things, it's doing something. Now, the key to this, if you don't mind my going a little further along on this, the key to this is the tithe. Now, this is something I never get weary of preaching about. In terms of Scripture, there were three tithes. And you wives, listen and bug your husbands about this. The first tithe was the Lord's tithe, of which 1% had to go to the priests. The rest went for the Lord's work generally. It included church music and a great deal more. The second tithe, which was every other year, so it came out to 5%, you see, annually, was the poor tithe for welfare. The third tithe, which was in intervening years, so that if the first, third, and fifth years were the poor tithe, then the second, the fourth, and the sixth was the tithe for rejoicing before the Lord. Again, that averages out to 5% a year, or 10% every other year. And rejoicing before the Lord, we would say a vacation, but a godly vacation for the joy of the family in the Lord, for their refreshing in the Lord. You see, God is mindful of all our needs. Now, what has happened today? All three tithes have gone by the board. Incidentally, there is no gift to the Lord according to Leviticus unless it's above and over the tithe. Now, with the tithe, all the basic social functions of society were taken care of in every Christian era. Health, education, welfare, everything. Until the last century or so, virtually every hospital in Christendom was a Christian hospital. It was a product of tithes. The Puritans started Job Corps training. That's a familiar phrase nowadays. They started Job Corps training for the people who were down and out to prepare them for new vocations. Schools were provided for everyone with tithe money. As a matter of fact, one of the most interesting things, and in one of my forthcoming books, in fact, in a couple of them I go into this, in the early years of this republic, we had 3 million people. When this country was established, when the Constitution was adopted, we had 3 million people. Before too long, the population was doubling every few years. A very sizable percentage of those people who came in after the founding of the Republic, some before, but mostly after, were Catholics, so this country within 20 years or so could have turned Catholic, but it didn't. A very large number were criminals and hoodlums. As a matter of fact, it became routine strategy for people in the various European cities, whenever they had a hoodlum and they wanted rid of him, they said, all right, you either go to prison and get so many lashes, or maybe the gallows, or we'll put you on a boat and you get out of the country. We'll put you on a boat for America. And for families that had delinquent girls who had become pregnant out of wedlock, to put them on a boat and send them across the country, across the ocean. And a lot of those girls immediately began to turn prostitute. They landed in Boston or New York or Baltimore with nothing. Nothing. It was a shocking situation. Now, what resolved it? De Tocqueville, in a very famous footnote in his original edition, and read De Tocqueville only if you can get an original, unedited version, writing about 1830, said that the worst cities of the world were the cities of the United States. And he felt that war was inescapable here unless revolution, unless a large standing army were raised by the United States to keep order in the cities and to suppress revolution. Well, de Tocqueville, in other areas, was a good prophet, but not in this one. What solved the matter? Thousands and literally thousands of tithe agencies sprang up across the United States to deal with these immigrants, to evangelize them, to set up Christian schools for their children, to set up groups or agencies to teach their womenfolk housekeeping in America, because conditions were so different, to give job training to the men, to teach them English. Every kind of training imaginable. Salem, I believe, and I traced Salem at one time, about 1790 had, I think, 3,000, and 1795 had 3,000, 1845, 45,000. The increase was almost all immigration. And yet it remained a typical New England evangelical community. How, with that tremendous influx that would have wiped it out as far as its old Puritan character was concerned? Simply through these tithe agencies. Now, it was when the tithe began to disappear that socialism appeared. And if you want to eliminate socialism, start tithing. And put your tithe to work for the Lord. Start creating Christian institutions, schools, hospitals, every kind of agency. Take care of the people in your circle. You know, one of the things that distresses me and makes me aware of how weak the church is today is the fact that there isn't a congregation which doesn't have its elderly that aren't cared for, and the church is sending money off to other areas. Think of the number of elderly where the husband or the wife is bedridden and they need someone to take them shopping. They need someone to come in regularly to clean house or to mow the lawn. Now, this is Christian action. And when the church begins to do this sort of thing, it's going to change its community as well as itself. Yes.
Back to the exchange relationship, that we are more or less now confronting a pagan society, in that respect, more parallel to the sovereignty of the Lord as confronted the sovereignty of the empire. There's this important difference where it cannot be set just as an either or, though. Isn't this true that we also have, from the point of view, let's say, of a Christian magistrate, we have a republic which, in some sense, is related to the concept of the biblical covenant. At least that's what the Puritan idea. This is part of our Christian heritage also. Well, let's say from the point of view of a man who's going to participate, he has an obligation not only to maintain the independence which we want to, which is primary, as so Paul described it, but we've got to confront this apparatus which has been superimposed on a biblical concept of the state. Isn't that right?
Yes.
In other words, it's not quite the parallel. In other words, we have, say, in Holland and Britain and Scotland, the United States, a confessional concept of this Constitution, on which this other business has been superimposed, so we've got to confront that also.
Exactly.
Or else we're not even being a Christian citizen.
Yes.
That's what I mean there.
Right.
The reality,
we have the Christian basis. Not entirely eroded. We have something we can work with. We also have this on our side. While we have extremely militant, bitterly anti-Christian people in high places, we also have many men without faith who would welcome a change. I have had some very interesting experiences in that area with governmental officials. I've spoken to a number of them have run across my Chalcedon report and have sought me out, including one man highly placed in Washington. Now, he's a man without any faith, and yet he's a man who's deeply disturbed about the direction of things. And he knows that our present intellectual position is morally bankrupt, and when government business brought him out to Los Angeles, and I didn't know he even knew I existed, he came by and spent an entire day with me asking me endless questions.
And there's no question in my mind that he and other such men, and that's just one instance of many, would gladly welcome a determined Christian initiative, a determined presentation of the biblical perspective with regard to the state, with regard to education, with regard to health, with regard to welfare, with regard to every area of life. And the faster we move into this area, the more readily we can avail ourselves of the willingness of some of these people who have, as it were, a Christian hangover to become useful to us.
In this respect, the kingship of Christ is twofold. You have it on this independent area where you know, love, and obey. We also have this kingship that is manifested, say, in the public court and the other area where his name has been the groundwork for its integrity.
Yes.
That's what I was thinking about, a psychological offensive that can be and should be waged in areas that we've just left unoccupied.
Exactly.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
The emphasis on common grace. The common grace element is special grace.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not too happy about the term common grace. I prefer to avoid it. But I know what you're saying, and I substantially agree. Yes?
Would you go over the connection between state education and the miniskirt?
Oh, yes. I forgot you asked me to go into that. Yes, statist education educates for immaturity, really. Because a statist philosophy is that the man is a ward of the state. That he is basically not competent to take care of himself. And so a statist education will educate for permanent immaturity, for permanent childhood. And as a result, you have progressively a growing immaturity in American life. People are permanently children. Tantrums are now a part of the American scene with adults as well as with children. I recall some years ago a woman whose dates were roughly 1860 to 1940 telling me that in her time, when she was a young woman and first having children, for a middle-class Christian husband and wife ever to have angry words with each other more than once or twice in their lifetime meant that their marriage was really on the rocks. You always spoke very respectfully to your wife and she to you. You never let your hair down. Now, you let it all hang loose, as it were. You just let go. This is the way. And marriages, Christian marriages, involve perpetual tantrums between people who really love each other. Now, this is a part of the childishness of our time. This woman told me in my day it was a mark of the lowest of the low classes to argue in public. As she said, I see church members, husbands and wives, doing very often now. Now, this immaturity reveals itself in many ways, including our styles. And the miniskirt is one expression of that. The miniskirt is a style, and this is not just my saying, this has been so recorded, was adopted from the dress that children wore a good many years ago, about 50 years ago. I know because I wore that type of mini dress when I was a baby. Boys and girls alike wore them because the purpose was you didn't have to take off pants to change diapers. You put them on the bed and flipped them up, and there were the works you could go to work on. Now, this childish style was deliberately adopted in order to convey the idea of perpetual childhood, perpetual immaturity. And so today, from early years on up to their 70s, women use this style, and they regard it as something really derogatory for anyone to speak of them as being something more than perpetually young. This is why, of course, the whole of the student revolutionary movement capitalized on the idea, never trust anyone over 30. Why? Because this perpetual world of childhood was beginning to desert them. By 30, they were getting married and having babies, and how could they go on being irresponsible, you see, footloose and fancy free, once that happened? So, no matter how much they might pretend to be in this perpetual world of youth, of childhood, they had really left it when they hit 30. Well, our time is up.
And I'd like for you to go over again something about a group that he spoke to on the second law of thermodynamics and the conclusion of some of the men when it soaked in.
This was Dr. Singer brought
Excuse
this
me, I was talking Russian, I didn't hear.
The fact of your having gone over Henry Morris's writings on the second law of thermodynamics and your scientists surrendered to that and said you could not hold to the second law of thermodynamics and to evolution at the same time, though they did not surrender their evolution. He wants you to repeat that.
Last spring, a group of us in the faculty have luncheon together, and we got talking about evolution. And so I turned to a very able and a very acute man in the realm of chemistry, and I said, Glenn, I said, how do you reconcile the second law of thermodynamics and the theory of evolution? He said, that's no problem. And then about a day later, he says, you just lit a bomb under me. He says, it is a problem, isn't it? I said, well, I just asked you the question. So he wrote, I showed him some work by Henry Morris, and that really bothered him. And he talked to another professor of chemistry, and that bothered him more. And then they wrote to a professor at the University of Tennessee in the realm of physics, and he's an exponent of the expanding universe, the exploded theories of 40 years ago. And he wrote back and gave a rather feeble defense of evolution in conjunction with the second law of thermodynamics. So by that time, I said, all right, I'm going to give you some real ammunition. So I wrote to Henry Morris, and he wrote back a very fine letter, and I wrote to Schlesinger, Don Schlesinger, and he had mimeographed or reproduced an article written by one of his own graduates, who is a professor at MIT. I forget the boy's name. I have the material, and I gave this to these professors of physics and chemistry, and before I realized it, I had the whole science department in an uproar. Physics, chemistry, biology, and geology were really, I've never seen them so upset. And to begin with, this article is beautifully written. It is an exquisite English. It's crystal clear, not to them, not to me. Part of it I really didn't get. Because he went into higher mathematics. You know how Fletcher is. I mean, when he's being clear, he's over my head. but it was all crystal clear to him. And these men were impressed. And they said, we have to give it one or the other. And the man in chemistry was very honest. He said, we can prove the law of second dynamics mathematically. We had the formula. Said, we either have to accept mathematical formula or accept theory. And most reluctantly, but very graciously, he said, I surrender. And he was so impressed with it that he had it reproduced in our own college reproducing machinery and gave it to his students to discuss and to write upon. And his advanced students could do it. The other students surrendered to Dr. Schlesinger because they didn't know what he was talking about. But it has created consternation in the circles there, because they admitted they couldn't answer. We have a brilliant man in physics, an extremely fine teacher in physics, who came to us because he was way over the heads of students at North Carolina State, and he came to us because at least we have few students that can't understand him. He really talks excellent English, but he goes into a space physics, and he really knows modern physics, and he was overwhelmed by the graciousness of the article, the beauty of the English of the article, but above all by the unanswerable logic of the article.
I may say, Dr. Roper, where the confusion came in, we had Dr. Henry Morris and his son John about 2 weeks ago. And if you're not familiar with Henry Morris's writings, he helped to write The Genesis Flood, and The Twilight of Evolution is probably the clearest explanation of the two laws of thermodynamics, if you are not familiar with those laws. But his son John, who is an engineer with the city of Los Angeles, has just returned from Mount Ararat. And so he spent some hour and a half showing us pictures. And miraculously, through answered prayer and such, he and two companions were able to make it to the top of the mountain. They are the first ones to do this, to the particular cradle where the ice lake is, where they think Noah's Ark is buried. And they operated within this, and during this time lost 35 pounds in the climb of body weight, approximately each person. They were fired upon several times. They had all their goods stolen, but when they got to the top of the mountain, they could see over into Russia. And this is the reason there's such trouble getting there, and were able to discover that what they thought to be an atomic plant at the foot of the mount on the other side. And he showed some extremely interesting pictures that the archaeologists say the first inhabitants around Mount Ararat left as evidence of their civilization there, which would have been Noah and his family. And one was the markings of a burial place where there were eight definite crosses carved into stone, which have been dated to have been before Christ, and the cross being used as a sign of man. There were eight persons aboard the ark. They found one cave opening where there were carvings of two human beings at each side of the cave, which very definitely were not of the type who now live in that region, offering very clearly a lamb in sacrifice, and some other evidences of an old civilization. They took some pictures of some carvings in a stone, which have been partially deciphered, and if their deciphering follows through and proves to be correct, it is somewhat of a diary account of the events of the flood, which will prove catastrophism and, of course, something pertaining to creation and God's intervention with reference to creation. But if you don't understand these engineering and physics laws of thermodynamics, read Morris and get acquainted with Harold Slusher from the University of Texas. We had him for 5 lectures. And get these things down, and then you'll have something to deal with some of these evolutionists with, in which they'll have to at least surrender some ground to our position.
I would like to ask a question concerning the Gary Allen book to Dr. Rush to me, because I'm wondering, do you accept any phases of this conspiratorial view?
The question is, do I accept any phase of this conspiratorial view? First of all, because I do not believe in the impersonalistic view of history, which holds that impersonal forces govern history, I do recognize that conspiracies are and have been always a real factor in history. They are not, I repeat, they are not, nor have they ever been, a determinative factor. Conspiracies operate on a supply and demand basis. For example, if we had untold billions of dollars and we set out to establish a conspiracy, all of us in this room with, say, $400 billion and with more on tap, to do two things. First, to persuade Americans to establish a monarchy, and second, to persuade all Americans to become vegetarians, we could spend all our money and get nowhere. For the simple reason, we would be going against the current of the day. What conspiracies do is to arise to meet a demand. They cannot, even with great funds, go against the basic faith and temper of a day. To cite an example, this country was never more extensively subverted by conspiracies than during the administration of George Washington. George Washington took over a country that was very weak, newly born, without any military or financial power, with not even 200 men as a standing army, and with nothing but debts. The French Revolution broke out. It was important for France to involve us and to get us to help them out by engaging Britain in war in Canada, so that once again the British would be tied down on this continent and thereby free France in its revolutionary program. All kinds of subversives were sent here. Money poured out almost without limit to buy up every person who could be bought up, even right up into Washington's cabinet. Never in all the history of this country has there been anything approaching so high a ratio of paid subversives in the country. And yet it failed. For a very obvious reason, you had a very large percentage of the people with a dedicated, thoroughly biblical Christian faith. Because of that, they could not subvert this country. It was an impossibility. Nowadays, we would be on the same road if we didn't have the subversion. In fact, I believe we would be further along, because I believe the Russian Revolution woke us up. It created a counter-movement, whereas prior to that, we were galloping into socialism. So, while I recognize, since I do believe that persons operate in history, I do not believe that the conspiracies govern history. That's a Satanist perspective. I believe the biblical point of view is best stated in Psalm 2. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth take counsel, or that can be rendered, conspire together against the Lord and his anointed. But he that sitteth in the circle of the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. And then the warning to the nations, to the conspirators: kiss the Son, lest he be angry and he perish in your way.
One other thing I'd like to ask, and that is, some of the ones that are holding to the conspiracy thinking are saying that that it's a Jewish conspiracy, and that they come from the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and different banking families, and they claim that all of this has come from back in the time of back around 722 BC, when the Assyrians carried off the 10 tribes and all this, and Now they have somewhere or other gone up into Armenia, up in that area, and they intermarried and different things up in there, and that they came from this what was called a Khazar Jew or something, and they say that Christ is not a Jew, but that he was a...
I'm familiar with all of that. I think I have in my library of some 15,000-16,000 books, perhaps 500-600 in that area, and I've studied it thoroughly. The Khazars or Khazars were a very real people who were converted to Judaism. You see, at the time that it became apparent throughout the world of that day that Christianity was triumphing, various countries felt that they had to abandon their old faith and take another religion that would have some capacity of resisting Christianity. The Khazar kingdom in southern Russia, Tatar kingdom, adopted Judaism, and one or two other small groups did. Most of them chose two other rivals. One was Islam, but mostly it was Arianism, which was a pseudo-Christianity, in reality Unitarianism, but really a death of God religion. They didn't believe in one God, they believed actually in no God, although they claimed to believe in one God. Now, this whole idea, I think, is nonsense. I don't know where to begin in analyzing, but I simply do not believe it. And I've studied it very thoroughly. I'm familiar with every writer in the field. It's a hodgepodge of half-truths and outright lies and a basic Satanism with regard to historical determination.
The question and answer period continues on the next tape. This conference was held at the Memphis Baptist Tabernacle in Memphis, Tennessee, in October the 19th and 20th of 1972. Other speakers who are available on tape in this conference on Christian schools was Dr. C. Greg Singer, and his series is listed at the Mount Olive Tape Library as GS221, and also Dr. T. Robert Ingram. His series is listed as TRI 100. And the other speakers, one message by Dr. Burnett Magruder and a lecture by Dr. Farrell Griswold. These messages are all excellent and speak directly to the issue of the Christian schools today.
Authorized by the Chalcedon Foundation. Archived by the Mount Olive Tape Library. Digitized by Christ Rules.com